Today is Wednesday. It's November 2nd, and it's 2:30-42 in the afternoon now. We got to get cranking. This is John Williams. Thanks for finding the Mincing Rascals podcast. Portions of this one will be broadcast Saturday night on WGN Radio, as they often are. And you can also hear me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
I'm Austin Burt from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm John Hansen from WGN Radio and Block Club Chicago.
I'm Eric Zorn, the Defiant, publisher of the Picayune Sentinel newsletter, online newsletter.
All right, we'll pick that up, Eric, but I did want to say thanks to John Hansen for making an extra effort to come into the radio studios today. He and I are on very expensive microphones.
Yeah, we are, boy.
Sitting next to each other in the broadcast studios while you guys are far and flung. What are you defiant about, Mr. Zorn?
I'm defiant about Twitter. I am not leaving Twitter just because Elon Musk is taking over and flinging open the doors
really?
To trolls and conspiracy theorists. I'm
really?
Staying.
You've got $8 for that blue check mark, mister?
I don't want the blue check mark. I think if he's going to charge $8 to people for the blue check mark, then the blue check mark is going to be go from being a status symbol to being a symbol of how needy you are.
Oh, interesting.
To be recognized.
Yeah.
Pretty sure that's what it already was. I'm not going to lie.
I did not ask for my blue check mark.
Yeah, you
I
couldn't.
Got the blue check.
You couldn't.
You couldn't. I got it, and I'm happy to have it. But if they take it away, I will not complain.
Do you have a blue check mark, John?
I did. I lost my blue check mark actually when I changed my Twitter name from John the Cubs fan to John Hansen Talks. I lost it then, but I didn't care. It didn't matter to me that I lost it, and it doesn't matter to your followers. It just doesn't matter.
Do you have one, Austin?
No, I don't. Do I want one? Yes. Am I man enough to admit it? Yes. But, you know, I do think it's a smart... Twitter right now is not a great profitable business, especially compared to its peers.
Eight of the last 10 years, it's lost money.
Yeah. Stuff like this is kind of what you need. And all these other platforms have really moved to a model where you have to pay for influence on the platform. You have to pay for reach on the platform. Twitter has never really made that jump as clearly as other platforms have. Maybe that's why some people still love it so much. But in order to compete and be a profitable business, they have to start instituting stuff like this. Now, to Eric's point, there could be this like unintended consequence of, well, people only want the blue check mark because it's this thing where it's bestowed upon you by the powers that be. And, you know, that's something, there's something interesting about that and valuable. Does it lose its value now that you can just pay?
Oh yeah,
you
right.
Can pay to have your identity verified on the platform. Essentially,
it's kind of like no cash bail now. Whoever has the money. by the way, Eric, why are you defending Twitter? So what's why?
I'm not defending Twitter. I'm just saying I'm not leaving Twitter. I still find a great deal of value in Twitter. I enjoy it. I get a lot of good jokes out of Twitter. I follow the news out of Twitter. When there's trials going on, I watch them. When there are big news events break. Storms and just crazy stories. Twitter is going to be the first place you can read about it. Things go on to Twitter from reputable news organizations before they actually post it on their sites. So it's good for that too. And I look and people like everyone on this panel and journalists all over town will post links to articles, information that I like to read. I think it's a great resource. And yeah, there are problems with it for sure, but I found it to be a really good tool. And I have ways. In fact, I'm going to have a list tomorrow in the Picayune Sentinel of five ways that you can increase and enhance your Twitter experience without and avoid the trolls and the hatred and the cesspool that is there if you're not careful. So I feel like it's still a good site if it turns out to be a bad site, if the racists and the haters and everybody get control of it and you can't avoid them anymore, then yeah, I'll leave. But right now, I mean, I know people are concerned, but I also think that Elon Musk is smart enough not to really to throw open the doors to everybody. I mean, he says he's into free speech, but when it comes right down to it, I think he's going to find that not only do his users not want that, but more particularly his advertisers aren't going to want that. They're not going to want to be associated with some of the bile that gets spewed on Twitter when you just let everybody say whatever they want.
Yeah.
And so I am thinking it's probably not going to change nearly as much as people fear it's going to, and I'm staying with it unless it gets really bad. So
yeah, I think the hysteria has been a little overblown about what would happen to Twitter when Elon Musk took over, because we have these things called mute buttons and block buttons, and yes, you see crazy conspiracy theories, but I don't think that they obviously spread like wildfire, but I think consumers of that wildfire will get it wherever they want to get it. It's not just going to be there because Twitter allows some of the spreading of misinformation. And I've just found, I didn't block or mute anyone for the longest time, and my experience in Twitter has gotten so much better. And I'm not an over-muter, but just if it's something that I keep on seeing, it puts me in a bad mood when I see that post from someone railing about X, Y, and Z, I just started muting them, and it's been glorious. And I'm now back to what I wanted Twitter to be in the first place. I think you can design your own experience in there and let the crazies talk amongst themselves.
I think that's a really good way of putting it, John. You can design your own experience. It's still possible. Now, if Musk decides that that's not profitable for him and he wants to make it difficult to design,
or he's going to charge you for that,
then I'll probably be gone. But as it is, I'm certainly willing to wait and see. And I know a lot of people are rushing for the exit. Someone said online that I'm quitting Twitter is the new I'm moving to Canada.
Absolutely. And that's the other thing that the folks, people complaining about the changes, right? It's a free service. It's right. Free. And I've gotten so much value out of Twitter for free for, as long as it's been around. And I honestly, regardless of the blue check mark, if someone was like, you're going to have the same Twitter experience, but you got to pay $5 a month for it, I would do it in a heartbeat. I think it gives me that much value.
Well, I'm glad to hear you guys say all that, because I found myself rooting against it, both for the fact that if he put Trump on there, or if he just turned it into a parlor, or if he continues to post things himself that he should take down and then not even apologize for, the Paul Pelosi thing, for instance. And so I'm rooting against the guy and therefore the platform, but I like Eric. I check Twitter every day.
Right. Many times,
many
I'm
times
sure.
a day. Yeah,
I do love the live negotiation of the price of the blue check
Started
mark.
At 20.
Yes.
Hey, show me 19. I got 18, yeah. 17. Somebody show me 15.
Yeah, exactly. But they settled on 8. It seems maybe moving forward, and everyone seems okay with that.
82-year-old Paul Pelosi was attacked with a hammer on Friday. And the husband of the Speaker of the House, an intruder looking for Nancy Pelosi, had plans to have her speak the truth. Whatever that meant, he wanted her to speak the truth, or he was going to break her kneecaps. His hope was that the sight of her being pushed in a wheelchair onto the floor of the House of Representatives would be a sign to other members of Congress to get it right about the elections, whatever that means. Since then, Donald Trump Jr. retweeted a comics meme that showed a pair of underwear and a hammer. Caption, "Got my Paul Pelosi Halloween costume ready." Carrie Lake, leading in the polls for governor of Arizona, said it's not impossible to protect our kids at school.
It is not impossible to protect our kids at school. They act like it is. Nancy Pelosi, well, she's got protection when she's in D.C. Apparently her house doesn't have a lot of protection. But
and the crowd and her host all laughed. Claudia Tenney, who represents the Central District of New York, posted an LOL with a picture of men dressed as Pelosi's attacker for Halloween. And it goes on. Even Elon Musk got in on the fun. I think the point they're trying to make is that Democrats are soft on crime until it's one of their own. At least that's the justification.
You think there was a point to what they were than those comments?
That's the point, in fact, that the former president's son said.
I was disgusted by the laughter in response to what Carrie Lake said. There was a one laugh that just cut through the audio there. And, of course, we don't know if everybody in the room was laughing. But, yeah, it's gross. It's a microcosm of what is wrong with everything. And you and I chatted last week. I had this idea of this civility conference between the former president and the current president to try and get the language to be a little bit more calmer. And regardless, it didn't go great on the
sure.
air. I got a lot
that,
of...
That's so sweet.
Okay.
That's what I said. Well, naive is another way to put it.
Well, right. But I felt like maybe President Biden could step up and invite the former president and see if he would be willing to chat about it. Okay, so obviously it was never going to happen, and the listeners let me know that tenfold. But I guess my ultimate point is, yeah, it stems from the leaders, and people love to blame the media for inflaming things. That plays a role. People love to blame social media that we're in these echo chambers, and that plays a role, of course. But if leaders keep on perpetuating this sort of stuff, it's going to keep on happening, and it just, whether it's violence amongst elected officials or it's just the general discourse that we all have these days crumbling beneath our feet. We need elected officials and people running for those offices to start behaving like adults and civil adults.
I think your line when you were on the radio that the last three presidents have negotiated with the Taliban, but they can't seem to talk civilly to each other was a stark reminder of what you were trying to accomplish there. I put it this way. Sometimes dark humor is the way we process things.
Right.
And I've laughed at things that I'm ashamed to say I laughed at over the course of my career and life. And I didn't say them on the radio, but I think we all understand that impulse. Part of the problem with some of this stuff is it wasn't even on the surface funny.
Right.
And if there was no point to it, I'm trying to throw the president's son a bone here, but I mean, if there was no point to it and it wasn't funny, now it's just hateful. And now it's just hurtful. Now we're sort of normalizing violence like a shrug. We sure didn't do that when Steve Scalise got attacked, I don't think.
No, in fact, the person that attacked Steve Scalise at one point worked for the Bernie Sanders campaign. And within hours of the attack, Bernie Sanders went on the floor of the Senate denouncing that anyone from his campaign would do something like that and calling for an end to any sort of violence.
Well, Mitch McConnell and others have called out this act of violence, too. It hasn't been completely silent on the other side.
Same with Steve Scalise. He called it out too.
Yeah, the point on the jokes is good. And what you need to look at is, well, is someone who's making that like extremely distasteful joke, if the shoe was on the other foot, what would their reaction be if a joke was made about the situation? Like if this had happened to someone close to Donald Trump Jr. and someone joked about it, what do we think his response would be on social media to that person? It would be, you know, nuclear war. So you have to be able to take it if you dish it and if you want to play in those kinds of, you know, dark places, which I agree people have a right to do. But to me, it seems this is an open and shut case of a disturbed person acquiring some vague political ideas and attacking a high level politician's home and spouse. And all of the evidence points to that. And I think anything to the contrary is very zany. I think we have his ex-girlfriend on the record saying he's mentally ill. He's been ill for a long time.
Other planes have said the same, but I'm sorry. So are you saying then that after the fact you can joke about it, or are you also suggesting that joking about it does not beget another incident like this?
Implied in much of the joking about it is that there's something fishy is afoot. Something weird is going on.
Sure.
And that, I think, is just totally... I'm reserving judgment in 2 weeks if there's some new... Or in a month or in a year, something new comes out. Maybe we can change opinions. But that to me, is actually the whole proliferation of conspiracy theories around this has been really rapid and disgusting.
And complete fictions, as best I can tell. I mean, there's not a thread to any of some of the things that are being said.
Well, there was just a lot of confusion that day, right?
Oh, sure.
We heard a lot of different things, and then, I think that breeds
conspiracies. All right, but you could have said Elvis walked out of a spaceship and hit him with a hammer, too. That would have had as much connection to reality as what some of these other things are.
I don't want to be too fair about this, but there were some very confusing police reports that said like a third person was in the house and opened the door for police. That turned out not to be true. There was some suggestion that the perpetrator was just in his underwear, and that turned out not to be true. And these were just like news reports that were coming out on the fly, misinformation that was going, and that was causing some confusion right at first. And I can see where people would say, okay, I want to hear more about this story. Well, who was this third person? That makes sense to me. We were all fooled by Jussie Smollett, or most of us were fooled by that for a couple of days. So you might want to, you know, just to step back and take in the information, but to take a more of a wait and see attitude rather than this is a conspiracy, this is an inside job, this is gay lovers, whatever they were trying to say. I mean, that was really irresponsible. I don't think it's irresponsible to sort of take a wait and see, find out what's going on, especially when the information, you know, the fog of of misinformation was coming out was weird to hear those things. Like, I was wondering, I was reading reports about a third person in the House, like, you know, and it just, some of it didn't quite add up at first, but yeah. I get that.
So at first we didn't even understand how it was that the police were summoned, but the reporting now is the guy broke the window.
Right.
He came in the back door. He approached him sleeping in bed. And then when he was able to at least get him to Mr. Pelosi, was said, I need to go to the bathroom. That's where his cell phone was getting charged. He was then able to call 911, and that was the summoning of the police. It makes sense now that you start to read the reports.
I don't think that still excuses the nastiness that it seems to be the currency in political talk right now, that more you get more points from being mean, nasty, sarcastic than you do for any sort of genuine kindness or appreciation or legitimate debate.
Well, it's easy to fall down the what about rabbit hole.
Right.
Because the other side will say, all right, what about Gifford, or what about Scalise, or what about Rand Paul, or what about?
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, you can play ping pong with those all day, or you can just say, no, I'm just going to talk about this one incident.
Mm-hmm.
This is terrible. It's horrible. Everybody should renounce it, and nobody should make jokes about it. The New York Times did a review of incidents, threats against members of Congress, and they said, based on their analysis, 30% of them have been against Democrats, 30% of them have been against Republicans. After Kavanaugh was appointed and after Affordable Care started getting dismantled, suddenly Republicans, as well as some Republicans who weren't sufficiently on the election denial bus, they were getting threats as well.
Okay, from their own party, right?
Yeah,
right.
So it was a little inside there. But it was kind of a 30-30. And then 40%, they say, of the threats against members of Congress now are from the tinfoil hat crowd, for which there's no real political ideology. Maybe this guy has his feet in two camps. They said that if there was a subgroup that is getting a high percentage of the threats, it's from female members of Congress of color, women of color who are members of Congress. So Ilhan Omar, AOC, I don't know if Lauren. They didn't mention Lauren Underwood, but I would imagine she might find herself in that company as well. And then the question becomes, how much security should we be affording members of Congress and their families? There's over 500 people there.
Right.
Each with a couple of kids.
A couple of residents,
is there a question,
too.
Yeah. Is there a question in anybody's mind whether we pay too much, whether we attach too much significance to the act of someone who is mentally ill, allegedly, in the case of the attacker on Paul Pelosi, or this one guy who went off on a rant leaving a message for Darren Bailey? A very weird, troubling, violent death threat. He got into an argument at a bar with somebody, got all worked up, and called Darren Bailey's office in Springfield and left this terrible, hateful message on his machine. And I'm just thinking, okay, that's a bad thing that this guy did. He should be prosecuted for it. But are we attaching too much significance to one person? We're saying, like, this is emblematic of the tenor of our times.
Maybe.
Are we going too far with that?
What would be interesting is to compare it to other maybe public-facing jobs in unsavory businesses. So, like, imagine you're the president of a loan collection company or something. How many death threats are you getting on a weekly, monthly, yearly basis? Or, I don't know, we could probably think of other examples. But I often think of I believe this was in the last city treasurer of Chicago, maybe even the current city treasurer, was really adamant about needing security all the time because they're the treasurer, as if they have like access to the money. So I think in some cases, this is overblown. And that is, you know, I would expect nothing less from people kind of in the political sphere. But I do think to make a trend out of a couple of instances is probably going too far.
Isn't the violence that we see, and again, we'd have to compare it to other historical trends and seen over the past, I see those as like the tip of the iceberg. It's the moments that catch our eye, but underneath the surface is this gigantic, horrible discourse that we have politically now where we cannot seemingly come together on much of anything, and there's just so much fighting, and we are splitting families apart that can't talk to each other anymore about political issues. And I'm more concerned about that part. These random acts of violence, I think I can go ahead and separate and say a lot of them are from mentally deranged people. They do need better security. We have other mechanisms for dealing with that. But I think that that is symptom of a much larger problem that will end up dooming us a lot more than just random attacks on politicians.
Some law enforcement officials call it statistical violence now. That is, if so many people are involved in such hateful discourse, it's almost inevitable that you're going to start to see these.
Right.
And so suddenly the tip of the iceberg, you go, well, maybe that's a one-off, or it's random, or it's not indicative of anything. But it is happening more often, at least the threats. And maybe it's easy to blow this out of proportion, Eric, but I think this came from somewhere.
Well, you remember the spate of political assassinations more than 50 years ago, when we had Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy and George Wallace and JFK as well. I mean, there was in that span of about 10 years, there were all these political shootings. And I don't think we've had, besides Reagan in 81, there hasn't been, and I guess, I don't know if you count Steve Scalise, that whole business, but for the most part, we haven't had. I mean, what I'm saying is that you could have made too much of that back, in the 60s and early 70s. Like, there's too much. This is going on. This country is going right toward. There's going to be
Civil
20
war,
in the next decade, and 30, and so on. So I'm just wondering whether these are they one-offs. The incident that I think is much more telling and troubling is still January 6th. I mean, the number of people who were involved in that was not a one-off. Those were normal Americans, for the most part, who were swarming the Capitol and threatening to hang Mike Pence and engaged in all kinds of very troubling
behavior. But you don't put this in. But Eric, that's the point. What happened to Paul Pelosi is part and parcel of what you're talking about, right? Since January 6th, we're seeing more and more of these. He may be the tip of the iceberg right now, but it's a pretty big iceberg underneath him, don't you think?
What have we seen since January 6th? We see Paul Pelosi, this death threat against Darren Bailey. Are we seeing lots more threats? I don't know the answer to that.
I do. Well, all right, here. The threats against members of Congress in 2016, threats against member of Congress, 902. In 2021, it's up to 9,625. Let me read the sentence again. Threats against members of Congress rose from 902 in 2016 to 9,625 in 2021. And I don't even like the idea of saying, well, this is a mentally ill individual. Sure, but I don't think that gets the politicians that are trading in this stupid discourse off the hook. And mentally ill people are able to control their impulses. There's a population of people, sane or otherwise, that are going to do violent things. And we are seeing more of it, or at least they're seeing more threats.
John, I didn't know you were going to bring facts into this article.
Where's Heather when I need her?
Yeah.
She bumped into me in the hall and said, here, use this on Eric.
Because otherwise, I would have kept my mouth shut.
Well, I don't want you to go away that easily, Eric. I mean, I'd like to think that it's not as bad as this one incident. And this is the worst incident we've seen.
Right.
This is very easy to latch on to and maybe milk for more than it's worth. But it did happen.
I do sometimes try and wonder if we were in a really civil period of about 50 years from World War II through the 90s. And that actually was abnormal compared to politics before then. And I've gone back. I love reading old newspapers and advertisements. And oh my goodness, the political strife that took place throughout the 19th century and some of the personal attacks on people, they were existent. So I maybe wonder if it's the era that we grew up in a lot. Well, I think everyone here and then beyond was just a remarkable time of civility. And we got used to that. And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Is the anomaly?
Right. What is the anomaly in our actual political landscape? I don't know.
I think to Eric's point, the 60s and the 70s, it's hard to overstate what that is. Imagine if you had a spate of assassinations of that prominence in the United States today.
Right.
What would be happening? It's just... It's almost unimaginable, and that's in our recent history. And then if you look, I was talking with someone recently about, like, man, about emperors and sort of autocracies and things of that sort. And the thing that people always forget about systems like that is most of them get assassinated brutally.
Yeah.
Like we forget about the sort of baseline normal status for politics throughout human history is the leaders are subject to violence, and we are living in this anomaly historically. Yeah.
By the way, Austin is the kind of guy who, hanging out with his friends, gets into conversations about the history of autocracies
around an IPA.
Yeah, right. A couple of guys with smart shirts and beards drinking these IPAs, talking about autocracies. The Bulls game is on the TV above them, completely oblivious to it.
Turn on C-SPAN. There's a House Ways and Means Committee meeting. I want to watch.
Oh, there's a hearing. I've got a day marked in my little calendar here. Sorry, Austin, you don't deserve
That's
okay. We appreciate the value to bring to this. Hey, while we're speaking of Austin Berg, a fact check by KSDK-TV in St. Louis says that the claim by your organization, the Illinois Policy Institute, that property taxes will go up if Amendment 1 passes, they scored that as false. You explained to us on this podcast that property taxes would go up by maybe $2,100. First, just walk us through that calculation and then maybe defend that claim. How did you guys get property taxes going up because of Amendment 1? And Amendment 1, by the way, is the Workers' Rights Amendment.
First question on your ballot, Workers' Rights Amendment, proposed amendment to the 1970 Illinois Constitution. It may not surprise you to know that I found that piece bizarre because the rationale seemed to be that property taxes will rise regardless of whether this amendment passes, but they will rise more slowly without it. So the way we got this estimate for how property taxes go up is the following. This amendment grants greater rights to government worker unions than any state in the country, and it prevents laws that would ever encroach on these new powers. So for example, passing a law that says you can only have contracts for a maximum of 5 years, that would be unconstitutional under this amendment because it is violating these new collective bargaining powers of government unions in Illinois, to take one example. So we said, okay, this is obviously going to have a one-way ratchet effect on taxes of all kinds, but particularly property taxes, which is the largest tax Illinoisans pay. So we said, what's a conservative low-end estimate for what we can expect property taxes to do if this passes? And we said, well, the lowest end we can do is it locks in the status quo growth. So we took the growth essentially in home prices and in property tax levies over the last 10 years, and then we projected it out to the next 4 years. Because what this does is it prevents any kind of reform that would reduce that growth. So that's why we say Amendment 1 is going to result in higher property taxes. And the estimate there for the typical homeowner is $2,100, excuse me. So I found that bizarre, and left unchecked still in this debate is the most misleading claim in the entire campaign, which is that this applies to all workers.
Yeah.
And it cannot trump federal law, which is where private sector unions are regulated. And you're seeing these TV ads over and over again, a guy with a hard hat, a nurse. These workers do not get any new rights under this amendment, and it's extremely misleading, and I would love a fact check on that from anyone.
What's the number on that, like 93 versus 7 or something?
93% of Illinoisans work in the private sector, 7% work in government.
I'm surprised that not a higher percentage. I know in some states it must be more, Virginia maybe or someplace, but only 7% of our workforce is publicly employed.
Statewide, I think that's right, yeah.
Wow.
So, and again, I think it goes beyond the property taxes as well. So what I was saying before about laws not being able to, you can't pass laws that encroach on these new collective bargaining powers. We looked through almost every state statute in Illinois. It took about 6 months, and we found at least 350 laws that would be overturned if this were to pass. Because what it does is it says these policies, for example, for discipline for workers, they're set at the bargaining table. And it doesn't matter what state law you pass, because that's going to intrude on what you can be bargained over, for example. So if you pass a law that says this should be the disciplinary procedure for police, for DCFS employees for fire. That's going to be struck down because this amendment protects that collective bargaining power that says we get to decide on this with politicians, not with voters.
Okay, just jump in. I want to make sure I understand that correctly because that is a lot. So if the Illinois legislature wanted to pass a law that affected how fire operated, police operated, some reasonable law that says if you do XYZ, the state constitution being amended would supersede any one of those laws, if it even encroached ever so slightly in that, and it would revert back to what happened at that bargaining table between that municipality and that union?
Because basically what it says is you can't pass a law that conflicts or reduces these quote-unquote collective bargaining rights. And at the same time, it also expands collective bargaining rights to include things like employees must be able to bargain over quote-unquote economic welfare. That's not defined anywhere. So you could see something happening like, for example, a vote to consolidate two units of local government. And the local union says, actually, this violates the Constitution because I get to bargain over my economic welfare, and you doing this takes it off the bargaining table.
But courts would be up to interpret what those
it would go to court. But the plain reading of the law is you can't restrict these rights. So I think in that point, people on the right and the left should be able to agree that this goes way too far, and that's what we've seen from every major editorial.
It doesn't strike me as being necessary, Austin. I mean, go ahead and negotiate the best contract you can get and then live with that. And then the next contract, do the best you can again. I think that's the way we all play ball. Why do you need to cement the thing with a constitutional amendment, right? I don't think anything's broke that needs to be fixed with an amendment.
Yeah, if I could jump in, I mean, I think I tend to be much more pro-labor than the Illinois Policy Institute. But I have a lot of reservations about constitutional amendments, because when you have an amendment that the wording is very loose, and Austin's right, they talk about other terms and conditions of employment and workplace safety that are protected, and economic welfare and things like that, that there's a lot of uncertainty, let's put it that way, about exactly how this is going to play out and what kind of impact it's going to have. And legislators, I would trust the General Assembly more than I would trust the courts to try to get in and fix this. If they say, okay, well, that was too broad, let's redefine this, let's narrow the scope of this. If you've got a constitutional amendment, the hurdle, as we know from other attempts to amend the Constitution, is really, really high. And this seems to me to be something that ought to be dealt with at a statutory level. Like, if they want to try to pass a law that says this, then fine. But as we know from the Safety Act and other things, that sometimes these laws, these proposals, they need adjusting as experience shows us how they impact in real life.
Yeah.
So I'm very conflicted about this because, like I said, I have an inherent aversion to amending the Constitution because we've seen how difficult it has been. And, for instance, I think that we ought to have a progressive income tax in the state. I think that putting the lack of a progressive income tax in the state Constitution 50 years ago was a mistake. 52 years ago, that was a mistake. We should be able to decide that legislatively. It was impossible to do as a constitutional amendment. I have some problems with the whole concept of constitutional amendments. And I also have problems with how vague the wording is on this amendment, even though I think I'm a lot more sympathetic to the notion than Austin is.
Well, do you think it's going to pass, Austin?
It's going to be it's hard to pass a constitutional amendment. So
can you explain how it's 3/5 of all votes? It's so confusing the way it's worded.
It's extremely confusing.
You're going to want to write this down.
Please.
Yeah, write this down. So it can win one of two ways. It can win with 60% of people voting yes on the question itself.
Okay.
So say there's 100 votes on the question itself and 60 of them are yes, it wins.
So it ignores anyone that left it blank.
Exactly. Okay. That ignores everybody who left it blank. Or a simple majority of everybody voting in the election. So 50% plus one of all ballots cast. Now, there's always a drop-off because some people read this and they're like, what the heck? I have no idea what this is. This is confusing. And they don't vote on it. If 16% of people don't vote on it, they need to hit that 60% threshold.
Okay.
That's a simple rule of thumb.
16%.
So I expect it's going to depend on, one is how misleading, how much does this ballot language sway people's opinion? because it's really written like the Sunshine and Puppies Amendment. It's we want to protect workers and their wages and their rights and hours.
I think you're
and that to me is something that really needs to be fixed in Illinois. People vote on this politically written description of the of the constitutional amendment instead of the thing itself.
I propose we have a constitutional amendment
to fix constitutional amendment.
Yes, exactly.
I have a dumb question.
We'll get that done.
Are you really excited? Are you happy that there is a no progressive tax in constitutional amendment?
Am I excited?
Are you glad that there is this no progressive tax amendment in the Constitution?
I'm glad. The flat income tax is one of the only taxpayer protections that we have in Illinois.
I'm just opening this up to saying that if you recognize that that's a constitutional amendment that you are support and are glad it's there, you could certainly see why someone who is pro-labor would say, well, this may not be a threat right now. I want this in as a constitutional amendment.
Yeah. Oh, totally.
So you're not against constitutional amendments to prevent future legislation from changing things?
Oh, no, not exactly.
If it fits with what you like.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's sort of it's about being a one-way ratchet and what is what politicians are able to do and not do. So to me, this actually empowers politicians to grant these really lucrative deals to government unions without any consequences from voters. And I don't think it's really taking away anything from politics.
And then if it passes, albeit you gave us the math on that, if it does pass, then that's the new constitution. It doesn't then go to somebody else. I want a constitutional convention where there's like 1,000 people sitting in chairs and they're all
with IPAs with the Bulls game on in the background.
No, but I mean, really, I would like a little more process than that, because I think the constitution is going to get amended, maybe not by the best informed voters on this issue. I don't know to whom I'm going to defer here, but maybe the assembly, but maybe not. I don't know. Somebody.
Every 20 years or so is this? I'm not sure about the interval, but it has to be put to the voters whether they want to have a constitutional convention. And it has failed. What was the last time?
I think Pat 2010.
Quinn, Pat Quinn was beating the drum for it in 20.
Yeah, he was.
Is that for a federal convention?
No,
for
a state.
But I think we should have a federal one, too.
I agree.
Although, boy, you want a civil war. God, try and rewrite the Bill of Rights.
Boy. Well, the problem with a federal constitutional convention is it would probably give the small states a lot of power in how the Constitution was rewritten.
Oh, that's right, because it's already stacked in their favor. If you're speaking about Senate representation or something like that, Eric, or electoral votes, is that what you're thinking?
Yeah. Yes.
Boy, if we could change one thing, I would. I'm sorry, I don't live in Wyoming, but California's screwed compared to Wyoming's representation in the federal government.
In Illinois, our Constitution is terrible. It was drafted in 1970 at a constitutional convention. There's tons of problems with it. Another constitutional convention would be great. It would be great for Chicago to even have its own constitution, like many big cities have.
Charters or whatever.
City charters. We really need there needs to be a lot changed about the Illinois Constitution. Here's one thing most people don't think needs changing about the Illinois Constitution. Let's give government unions more power in Illinois than they currently have. That should not even be in the top 300 things that needs to be addressed in the Constitution.
And that's about to happen.
If people are frustrated by that and they're like, I want to, instead of voting for either, new and higher taxes or more government union power, why can't we vote on some other things in the Constitution? Why can't we vote on term limits in the Constitution? Why can't we vote on pension reform in the Constitution? Instead, we only get the option to vote for more government union power.
Wouldn't pension reform be if you could pick one thing that we would change? And clearly we know where you stand on Amendment 1, but I mean, what would be the one thing you'd like to see a constitutional fix to in Illinois? And I think a lot of us would say, if we're not receiving a pension from the state, that we need to find some way to claw some of that back, right? I mean, isn't that the biggest thing dragging our state down?
Yeah, we've polled on a constitutional amendment that would not cut a dime from any existing pensioner, but change benefits going forward, change that 3% cost of automatic compounding wage increase post-retirement. And a majority of Illinoisans support that. And I think that really, if you care about quality government services, if you care about attracting businesses to Illinois and good jobs to Illinois, I think that would be the number one constitutional amendment I would put on the ballot. But there are many others, too. For example, independent maps. That's been tried multiple times to try to get in the Illinois Constitution to stop gerrymandered maps. I think that's
I'll link that
too.
As long as the other states agree to it.
Eric, I was just going to say, Eric's not going to get on that bus. Are you, Eric?
I will if we... If it,
what are you eating?
Federally. No, I just choked on my own thought, which was that I'm totally on board with the idea of district maps drawn in an impartial or nonpartisan way. But if we do it in Illinois and they don't do it in Wisconsin or North Carolina or wherever, you know, Texas, then it's just Democrats unilaterally disarming. And I'm not in favor of that.
I have one tangent thought just really quickly, John. You mentioned the electoral misbalance in the Senate where someone in Wyoming is represented by two senators and same in California. It's the only reason we have a country was that that was a compromise. It was the only way you were going to get that, a House and a Senate. And so that's what we got.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, and so fine. It wasn't even as disparate back then as it is now. But you do agree that now.
Oh, it's crazy. I'm just telling you how I get to sleep at night. It's like, well, we wouldn't have been here if it wouldn't have been for that. So
yeah,
that compromise.
I guess so. What would we have been then? We would have been like Europe? Would have been a bunch of little independent states?
I don't know. They would have gone back to the drawing board.
Yeah.
With a bunch of IPAs. No, I'm just... I'm just on this image of a bunch of Austin's friends together.
Yeah.
I'll get off of it.
Well, guess what? You aren't getting invited to that party, so don't worry about it. What about this? Out of the blue, Lori Lightfoot, the mayor of Chicago, made herself available to us at WGN Radio today. They reached out to my show and the afternoon show with Lisa Dent, and the Lisa Dent show was is she appearing on Lisa's show yet? She was able to make it. She wasn't able to make it on my show. I'm glad she was on with Lisa, although I would have preferred she'd been on mine. But Lisa and I were talking in the halls, going, why did the mayor make herself suddenly available? And then what questions? It's like, I'm sorry, this is a pretty big radio station we run here. We're players, and the mayor never comes on. She used to with Steve. No, it was Rahm Emanuel would come on with Steve Cochran
right,
all the time. And since then, we've kind of been striking out. And we like to think it's because we ask the tough questions. I don't know why the mayor.
There's been a recent openness by the mayor with other news outlets as well.
For instance,
at Block Club Chicago, there's been more opportunities for post press conference side chats, inviting to budget discussions off on the record, budget discussions, some off the record, and we hadn't seen that for
I've
a
heard
while.
Her on sports stations in town talking about the Bears
right.
in the stadium, which is fine.
Could it be there's an election?
It's almost like she's running for re-election.
Yeah.
Listen, I get it. And Chuy Garcia looks like he's going to be a formidable opponent for an election 5 months from now. Or how long is it before we even get to vote for Lori Lightfoot or Chuy Garcia?
It'll be
end of February. So November, December, January, February, 4 months from now. So maybe it's that obvious, but I would like to ask her where she stands on the cash bail issue right now. Just going back to that for a second. Is it generally known what her position on this is?
Great question. I have not heard her say much about it. But you would think she would have to have been asked something like that at a press gaggle, don't you think?
I haven't heard it.
But I've not seen headlines about what she specifically wants to would do or would advocate for in Springfield.
John,
I can just hear Heather Sharon listening to this podcast tonight yelling at us through the phone.
Can I just take this as an example of – I mean, I like the idea of getting rid of cash bail. I don't think that whether you're rich or poor should rule whether you get out of jail or not if you're charged with a crime. You're sort of essentially criminalizing poverty. But I want to see how it works. And if we were to make a constitutional amendment to get rid of cash bail, then changing that, fixing it, adapting it would be very difficult. So let's make it a law, and then let's make it easy enough to change that law if it turns out that getting rid of cash bail is a rotten idea. It might be a good idea. It might be fine.
Well, we haven't amended the Constitution to that effect, right?
No, we haven't, but I'm giving you an example as to why I'm very wary of constitutional amendments. If you get this is a great idea, let's put it in the Constitution, make it impossible to change. I think that that's my hesitation about constitutional amendments in general. I'm sort of circling back to the previous point, but I like the idea of getting rid of cash bail, but I'm also open to the idea that it's not as good an idea as maybe I think it is.
Yeah, I am too. I'm wary of it as well. Better it be a law than an amendment, and better it be an amended law that they ought to do something about it. What we've talked about that on this podcast before. J.B. Pritzker says amend it, don't end it, but nobody's been clear about how they're going to amend it or if when. They, in fact, are.
Right.
Yeah, when is this going to happen? Because the thing goes into effect in a couple of months, and then the criminals will be roaming the streets.
Purge.
I know.
There have been three trailer bills, I believe, passed already. I mean, they've been doing tweaks on this for a while.
On that, but per se?
Yes, on the Safety Act.
And have they amended
the... so bizarre.
Have they amended the categories of crimes, Austin, to your knowledge?
No, I think these were other sort of technical changes because it was passed so... It was introduced, then passed so quickly that they found things in there that were not even intended in the original law. So there was always... There were these trailer bill fixes.
Do you think they're waiting till after the election to then do a lame duck rewrite?
I think it's very possible something they could do something in lame duck because you then you'll have a lot of what I expect will be lame duck legislators who will be able to be swayed more easily rather than having them take a vote on this right before the election.
You don't think it would help Democrats to amend it before the election to show the people in the middle, we get it, we know you're afraid, and our bad, we'll amend it now. I'm wondering about the timing.
That could be true. Maybe it ends up hurting them, the fact that they didn't go back and fix it. But, you know, the problem there is, one, is it actually a fix to anything? And two, do proponents just use it to put it into the news cycle again?
Right.
And I think that's kind of what Democrats were hoping,
right.
Which
they
was,
don't
let's
give.
Just lay low.
Yes.
Yeah, we don't want to have all these hearings on this right now. We don't want to draw more attention to it. But I think that's kind of backfired because it just seems like they're not doing
it. Well, where are you on it? On the issue generally, bail.
On cash bail, there's very good reason to think that we should reform that system. Now, the question is, the devil's in the details, though. So I'm really concerned about the fact that it's rolled out to the entire state all at once with all these state's attorneys saying there's problems in this, where you could have done a pilot program in one county. Or done a trial period statewide or something like this. Instead, it's this gargantuan piece of legislation that really transforms the justice system. And if there's anything, the Illinois government is anything if not. How am I trying to say this? It's not a dynamic institution that can change very quickly
there
to
you
all
go.
These new things.
We got that message.
There's going to be huge problems
but here's the
with
the
implementation.
But I do disagree with that. I want to push back a little bit, Austin, because I think that when we have the bad things that will inevitably happen because of this law, you're going to have some example where someone was out of prison when they maybe shouldn't have been. They were released because they killed someone. That's going to be loud. That's going to be splashy, and everyone's going to attack it. And any pilot program would be attacked. And
It'll
I think
be like
the
Scream
water.
Ad. They'll
right.
treat it like the Scream
but
ad.
But the good things in the bill that could change systematic problems that exist, that this changes. Do not get splashy good news moments. So it's almost, in my view, better to change it because if it had entered some sort of pilot program, it would never get off the ground and get going.
I'm sympathetic to that view, definitely. But I do think among people who think there needs to be significant criminal justice reform, I think there's plenty of reasons to not be happy with the Safety Act. It's precisely for that reason. Because of the way it was passed, not really with buy-in from all of the public safety stakeholders, which you're not going to get 100%.
Right.
But you got to get more state's attorneys on board. You got to get more police on board. Because if you don't, you're setting yourselves up for this really bad boomerang effect where everyone's calling it their shot. They're saying there's going to be some bad things in this bill. And what you could see is an overcorrection the other way, jacking up mandatory minimums, right? You could end up worse off. And that, I think, is also the argument for splitting it up into smaller component parts rather than this massive.
I always like that approach when they can do that. I'm looking at the clock, Austin. I know you got to exit this podcast today, but I was wondering if you could just comment on one last thing, or don't if you can't. But did you see John Oliver's 27-minute monologue about no cash bail? He just did it last week, and he talks about Lori Lightfoot. He talks about Illinois, and he makes the point that other states that have instituted this have not seen crime go up. So maybe Illinois is different than New Jersey, but if you did want that sort of trial balloon, half a dozen states have had it, and they have not seen crime escalate. And in fact, he makes the point that maybe it actually
deters future crime because the guys haven't been locked up for a year and lost their job.
Right.
You know, now they're going to get into trouble when they get out. Let's get them out of jail, keep them on somebody's payroll. They're not guilty of a crime until they've been found guilty of a crime.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I think the problem is we mischaracterize this thing, this part of it, of the Safety Act. It's not designed necessarily to make the streets safer. It's designed to not wrongly jail people. And let's hope that it does also make us safer, or maybe it's neutral. But I think it's not necessarily a round peg in a square hole, but it doesn't make the streets appreciably safer. I think it still has merit because we're locking people up who don't have money, and people who do have money get out. Austin, your witness.
Yes. Pre-trial detention is really important to get right. You want to make sure that people aren't being held against their will and having their freedoms taken away just because they don't have money to pay. I think plenty of reasonable people can agree on that. The devil's in the details of how that is implemented. What you really need in order to have that work is a very robust risk assessment system that is going to be better than cash bail. And I think what the critics of this are getting right in some instances is that this risk assessment system and the categories of crimes, they're not better than cash bail for making sure that truly dangerous people stay in detention prior to trial.
I think that's what terrifies a lot of us about it. I think that's what Eric might have been alluding to. Austin Berg, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, what a...
Checking out.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Austin. Good to hear you, my friend.
I wonder if we'll get a lot less plea deals, too. They say that the pretrial detention leads to a lot more people pleading guilty to crimes they feel like they didn't commit as a way to get out.
I hate to keep deferring to this John Oliver piece, but they had the story of a guy who was incarcerated for 11 months for a crime he didn't commit. He couldn't get the cash to get out. He finally said, I'm guilty. And they said, well, we've held you for 11 months. That's longer than if we had found you guilty. So they let him out. And then they cut to Chris Christie. Chris Christie was an advocate for no cash bail for that very reason.
No longer must you stay in jail for minor offenses longer than you would have if you'd actually be convicted of the crime which you're accused of committing. Just because your family doesn't have $500.
John Oliver's good.
Yeah, I didn't see this. I got to watch it.
But it's a really deep dive into this.
I will link to it in tomorrow's Picayune Sentinel.
Yeah, I think you should. And, you know, he does make the concession, sort of like Austin now, that maybe it's not perfect.
Right.
You know? And I'll get that. But other states have tried it, and it doesn't sound like the criminals are driving school buses and taking your children's lunch.
But you know there will be examples, right? There's going to be occasions where someone's let out that it wouldn't have been before, and there's going to be these little things that you hold on to that is going to blow this up.
Yeah.
Well, there are already a number of instances, and certainly CWB Chicago, the website that tracks crime in town, likes to chronicle them, where people who are accused of violent felonies who bail out or who are put on home monitoring, they go and they commit another crime. And this is already happening. And as Austin said before he left, it's very important to get pre-trial detention right. And it's almost impossible to get it right in every instance. But, you know, you can't keep people locked up unless you can really demonstrate that they are a threat. And sometimes they don't appear to be a threat, and then it turns out that they are. And so it's a tough situation, but I'm not sure this is going to make it any worse, is what I'm saying. Now, I hate to argue with the states, the 100 out of 102 states.
That's pretty weird. I can't get my head around that. That is pretty. They keep deferring to Jim Glasgow, the Will County state's attorney, who is a Democrat in name only. He is a Dino. I don't know if that's a thing. But
that's a thing, yeah, sure.
But by the way, do you think we were a little too hard on Austin, making fun of him and his fancy friends drinking
beers?
Oh,
no, I think he likes it because it's true.
He was kind of smiling, but the kind of smile you have when you're not going to get into the fight because there's three of them and only one of you.
Well, wait 20 minutes, send him a text. I think that'd be nice, John. If you just said, you sent him a little, I hope that was okay.
Yeah,
that'd be appreciated.
Send him a little heart emojis.
Right.
Love you.
Are you loving any Cubs memories today, by the way?
Oh, this is the anniversary as we record this today of the Cubs winning. Actually, this technically tomorrow is
I was in Cleveland, so
November
I celebrate tomorrow.
3rd was the day, it was after midnight that the Cubs won in Cleveland. I don't know if we said this on this podcast, but I'll never forget that night because my son, who was so tied to the Cubs, our family was so, the city was so into that, of course, although a lot of us have gotten off the Cubs bus since, but Grant couldn't take it anymore in game seven. And so he just started to walk the neighborhood and he would look into people's windows and check on the game. But it was just so exhausting to him to watch. He couldn't take it, and he walked away from his TV in his condo. He was probably the only guy walking the streets of Lincoln Square or wherever he was living at the time. And just, you know, so by the way, if in Chicago,
there's one guy that was wandering.
That guy that was looking in your window the night the Cubs, that was my son.
He just wanted to see what was going on.
And he was just checking on his mental health, and then he was going back on and walking down the street some more.
It's that whole series, I just love to just revisit it sometimes, and I'll kind of read the Wikipedia summary of each of the games and try and relive it, because it's as close in sports as you get to the drama of theater, the ups and the downs. It was just so perfectly written. I don't know if you could have designed a more perfect way to win the World
Series. It was Hollywood, wasn't it? And then the rain delay.
Yes.
And then the guy who hasn't been delivering with his bat so much says, guys, we know we're better than this.
Yes.
You go out there and you win this game. And that happened.
Yes.
And then they went out and did it.
Yes. And then they scored two runs in the top of the 10th, but that wasn't enough drama. They had to give up one more run and put the tying run on second base.
Cut to the manager who's making decisions that not everybody agrees with.
Yes.
And lo and behold, he's redeemed in the end. It's, or was he?
Yeah, right. It was so cool. And I just remember calling my dad that night, right? And did the stories you'd see in the paper and in the TV later of people that brought the radio to the grave of their parents to listen to the game with it. And it just, it felt so good. And it just also reminds me that day opens up a portal to this alternate universe that then changed a few days later with the 2016 election.
It is hard to believe that those things happened so closely.
So close.
And I remember what a salve the Cubs were for us that fall, because when your team ends in the regular season, it's a long time between then and the World Series.
Yeah.
But we had that to sort of get us over the hump, which was coming. And my brother went to one of the Cubs games at Wrigley.
Mm-hmm.
So he's at, but he's on a, was he on a rooftop? He was on a rooftop, and Grant was actually in the stadium, my son. Or maybe it was the other
way
around.
Was he walking around the aisles and looking in through the concourses?
He wouldn't even watch the game. One of them was on the rooftop, and one of them was right field bleachers. And they saw each other across Sheridan, I guess it would be.
Oh, Sheffield, yeah.
Sheffield. And so my brother sees my son, and he texts him and says, turn around. And they make eye contact. And then my brother shouts across the street, I love you. And my son shouted back, I love you too. Boy, you talk about human connections.
Yes.
Eric, I'm sure you must have stories like this.
I'm thinking about the 85 Bears right now. This is so sad. These would be the Chicago sports fans going way back in the
past. It's 6 years.
I don't know. How long ago does that feel to you?
It feels six, I will say.
It feels a long time ago to me. How about you, Eric? Given
how mediocre, I mean, it looks like the Bulls are going to be, okay, this year, but they're certainly not going to win the NBA championship. And the, of course, the White Sox were a terrible disappointment, and the Cubs almost deliberately sucked this year. It looks like the Bears are going to win maybe, what, five, six games?
They're trying to lose games now.
And even this, got rid of Roquan Smith. That was terrible, I thought.
But why live in this mediocrity? Eric, just
embrace. I know, that's why it's so sad.
It's not sad. When we're on our last days, we will all remember that day, and it will bring me joy.
But those Chicagoans who are still sucking off of the 1985 Bears teat, you got to let go. That thing is dry, and it's done.
Well, hold it in your heart.
And I hate, by the way, I hate that analogy I just dreamt up, but I do sort of roll my eyes at Bears fans or that whole love of the team. Dan Hampton's on our station a lot, and we love him for it, but I think this sort of long-last embrace of the 85 Bears shows how desperate we are.
Well, I think that there's a fine line between holding on to a memory that you love and using that as an excuse to cover up for all the mediocrity that there's been since, or that's the only that's what we have to resort to. I don't think that'll happen for the 2016 Cubs, mainly because a lot of them went away the next year or the year after that. But it was such a different circumstance, but I don't think there's anything wrong with just remembering it on that day. I'm not saying every game I go to Wrigley Field in May, I'm
stop
like,
you
well,
on a bus and go, hey, do you remember the thing?
Yes.
I go, dude, yeah, it's June 4th. Shut up.
Austin was not born when the 85 Bears won the Super Bowl.
Austin wasn't born when the Cubs won the World Series in 2016. He is such a rising star in this town. We can talk about him
totally
because
agree.
He's not here. But he's tall, he's thin, he's handsome, he's erudite, he knows his stuff, he leans a little conservative, but he's able to have both feet in reality. I don't know how he isn't a featured columnist in one of the papers like they have those anymore, or he hasn't found a bigger platform. Illinois Policy Institute's legit. I'm not taking anything away from him. And he's got his own podcast, and he's co-authored books. But I think his future is bright.
I agree. Although now I feel like we've made fun of him and his friends and called him an underachiever all at once. But rising star. No, he's awesome.
He's a rising star. I actually tried to see if the Tribune would hire him as a regular columnist when I was there. And they just – I mean, it's they like it. And they run his work when he writes it. But they just don't have local columnists anymore.
Well, we call him a lot early in the morning, go, hey, Austin, there's this really complicated thing we don't understand. Will you come on and explain it to us? And then he says yes, and he does, and he does it great. Oh, hey, one last thing before we wrap up this podcast. Speaking of things I couldn't get, you've been running a trivia question on your show, New York, Illinois, and Las Vegas.
Yeah,
Nevada.
New York, Chicago, Las Vegas.
Oh, the cities.
Three top cities.
And one, just do it for Eric and see if he can guess it.
All right. The number one city of these, 190 of these exist in New York. 190 in New York City. 180 of them exist in Chicago, putting us at number two. And 170 of these exist in Las Vegas, chalking it at number three. So New York, Chicago, Las Vegas. The top three in the country spots of what?
And none of them more 200. And I thought it would be OTBs.
Nope, not that. Had a lot of good guesses on the show. We did get an answer last night, so I can reveal it.
Eric, you want to say museums?
Nope.
Somebody guessed that last night.
Erotic massage.
No.
Thank you, Eric.
That was a good one.
But we do need more, Eric. Yeah. You're absolutely right. Thank you for bringing that
up. We could be
up.
Number one one day. You want the answer?
Yeah.
Starbucks. Starbucks.
Wait, we got 180 of those on Michigan Avenue.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And in Las Vegas, because people are like, well, what about Seattle and Oregon? That's where you think they'd be. And there's a lot of them, but they don't have the population that Chicago and New York does. But neither does Las Vegas, but it has the tourism. So it has so many Starbucks.
So maybe Honolulu would be disproportionately higher
probably,
on that list, too.
Probably.
And somebody guessed that last
Someone night. Got it. The last guess of the night.
And what did they win?
A shirt. I feel like that one took a week. Some of our
they should have gotten five shirts.
They should have gotten five shirts, yeah. We don't got five shirts.
That's John Hansen, who's not always able to join us. And you also heard Austin Berg and Eric Zorn. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. And we will drop another pod on you next week. John, you had so much energy
thank
our
you.
Little podcast.
Yeah, it was fun.
That was a lot of fun.
Why do you always not come on? Why, you good not be?
I wish I could. It's this Wednesday. I mean, there's no
Should
good
we move
time.
To a different date for you?
I mean, no, do not move it for me. Fridays are great, but who wants to do a Friday?
I can't do Friday.
Exactly. And Mondays are...
I can't do Friday, but
I could do a Monday, but what are we talking about on a Monday?
Yeah.
You got to let the week...
Maybe you could change
Coming
your...
here is easier than doing it via Zoom, so I might have to do that, but I don't want to invade your space all
Maybe
that often.
Maybe you could quit your other...
I kind of liked it with you guys together. I don't know. In some ways, I know that it's actually better to do face-to-face and
We used to do this in studio, like remember?
There was some good... I mean, there's some extra little chemistry there for you.
Yeah.
Well,
all right. Thanks,
I'm so used to Zoom.
I know. You know what, Eric? Are you over the hump? Would you come into the studio if I paid for your parking?
I can't on Wednesday. Wednesdays are my one crazy day of the week.
Yeah.
I can't on Wednesday. So.
All right, we'll figure it out. I mean, well, here's what we'll figure it out. All right, we'll do it on Wednesdays. And we'll take John Hansen when we can get him.
Yeah.
Okay, guys.
Yeah, that was great, John. Thanks. See you
Thank
guys.
You.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.